When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. What was Joseph Smith Jr.'s religious life like? It turns out his parents were quite different religiously. Joseph Sr. was probably what we would call spiritual but not religious, while Lucy was more of a visionary. Which one was Joseph Smith more like? We'll find out more from Dr. Mark Staker. He's the author of Joseph and Lucy Smith's Tunbridge Farm. And we'll talk about the archaeological dig and things that we can find out from archaeology that affect Joseph Smith Jr. as well. So you won't want to miss this episode. Check it out.
After we did the primary home site, we had a little bit of time, just a few days, where we wanted to look. We knew, based on the family that owned the property, they told us, yeah, there's another building site here close by, covered by leaves, and nobody had noticed it before. We wanted to figure out what it was, and we knew we couldn't excavate the entire thing, so we did some test trenches that would tell us some things about that building. It's an outbuilding, but it turned out to be really important to the story, because as I mentioned earlier, we knew that the Smith family had turned their hills into pasture where they had cattle, and that they hadn't plowed it regularly. Well, Lucy says in her account that after she and Joseph married, that her husband turned to cultivating the land. Well, cultivating is not quite the same as plowing, but it sounds pretty similar. So what's going on here? What does she mean by cultivating, weeding it, you know, and growing some crops there? And yet they have to be perennials, because he's not plowing every year. You know, 6 or 7 years of plowing would have pretty much worn those little bumps away, and so you wouldn't have that on an even surface. Well, we knew from the local town historian, Euclid Farnham, that hops were the first cash crop in Tunbridge. And so that was something we were interested in. Okay, well, are they going to grow hops? And we knew just from the history of Vermont and of this area that apples were also a major crop in the area. And actually, there are apple trees growing wild on the property, and we did some research on those, and we're able to identify the varieties. They're all early varieties that were being grown when the Smith family settled the property. One of the varieties actually originated down in eastern Massachusetts. It could well have been brought up with them when they moved north. And so we knew we had these two options. It could be apples or it could be hops. And then there are potentially other options that we don't haven't yet identified, but we don't know what those might be. But we were interested in those as we began to excavate this other building, did the test trenches. And we confirmed that this building had been used to house a kiln of some type. We found they'd taken mortar and leveled off part of the flooring so that it was all level for something heavy that needed to be kept level and couldn't be even just thrown on a dirt floor. But the most of the floor had been originally dirt, and we could confirm that. So we knew it hadn't been used as a cooper shop. You can't do coopering on a dirt floor. You get dirt in those staves, and you don't get a tight barrel. It leaks all over.
Yeah, because the barrel making, essentially.
Yeah, cooper is barrel making, and so so we knew that hadn't been done there. We knew it wasn't a barn. Barns also had dirt or wood floors, and they weren't used to house animals at the time. You did that in a stable. And in a stable, you don't build. These foundations were massive, you know, 20 inches wide, and a good 30 inches deep in some areas. You're not going to do that for your stable. So those options were eliminated, and it left hops and apples as our two options. They had some kind of a kiln or some kind of an apple press where they were drying hops, or they were pressing apples and making apple cider.
So it could have been both, or do you think it was one or the other?
Could have been both, but probably more likely one or the other, because you're not going to have a kiln and an apple press in there, but you're going to have one or the other. Kiln makes the most sense, and the reason is because you can take that kiln then and dry ginseng.
Okay.
Ginseng takes you 45 days to dry to get ready for market, just hanging it up. As they say, like tobacco, you know, you have a string, you hang all your ginseng roots up on these strings, and it takes all that time to dry it, and you need the space and everything, and it's, and Joseph Smith Sr. did thousands of pounds of it.
Well, and ginseng's where he had his big financial disaster, right?
Yep, and so we know that he had ginseng. We've gone through that whole process, too, and how much would he have processed, how would he have done that, where would he have done that, and this is the perfect place for him to take care of that. And so that connection of most likely hops and needing a place for ginseng suggests that this was an oast, and an oast was a building that you built to dry hops in. Okay. And there are still surviving oasts in the area from that time period. We need to do a few, some more research. We need to do a pollen study to confirm that, and hopefully that's underway. We're trying to get some grant money to do that. And
see, so this is an ongoing project still.
It's ongoing. There's more to learn.
Is this going to eventually be like a big visitor center where you're going to recreate the
this
home?
This is privately owned property from Scott and Patricia Beavers, who let us do research there, and so it was
just letting you be nice.
It was our own work of scholarship that we wanted to know more about the family in this setting.
Interesting.
So we learned details about that factory, that additional building, its size, dimensions, maybe potentially some of the ways that it was used. We were able to document that as well. And that's discussed in the book, too. And then there's, excuse me. The whole picture of this property, as we figured it all out, you know, how did it all look, what's where, helped us then suggest some things about the history of the family and the site. And one of those is that Lucy Mack Smith has a dream. Right before the, you know, after the family gets involved in ginseng, end up losing everything in the process, and that's a whole interesting story in and of itself. But
well, I know Richard Bushman talks about that, because that was a big deal, because it basically decimated them financially, right?
It did. Took everything that they had, and then some, and so it was very devastating. They had to sell their property and leave this site. And right before that happens, Lucy talks about going out into a grove and praying, and then she has this dream. Well, because we understood the property, she talks about these cherry trees, blossom and so on, we could place her down in the cemetery. She'd gone to the cemetery to pray. Why there? They had a child born. Before Asel, or before Alvin, and we know that other people were buried in that cemetery. His headstone doesn't survive, probably was just made out of wood. Often they were, you know, made out of wood, and those don't survive. And but she had gone down to the cemetery to pray, probably where her child was buried. And after that, she goes home and has a dream. And in that dream, she sees this little valley with a stream and these two trees by it. One's her husband, Joseph Sr., and the other is her brother-in-law, Jesse Smith. Well, if you go to that site, there's still a stream there, a natural spring. The water runs down, it goes down through the cemetery and on down the mountainside. Aren't trees there anymore in the meadow part of it. Those are gone, but you can imagine trees there at one point in time. And Lucy's dreaming about her own little valley, only in symbolic terms of her husband and how he'll respond to the Holy Spirit, and her brother-in-law and how he'll respond to the Holy Spirit. And so she doesn't give all that context, and she's just telling the spiritual aspects of it. But by looking at the site, we were able to place that in a location and actually understand a little bit more about that dream because of that. So the family then sells the property, leave that home behind. They didn't sell it for as much as Lucy remembered them selling it for. The price she gives is for what her father-in-law sold his property for, so she must have kind of, we're talking 40 years later. She's just kind of mixed up some of those details, I suspect. But they sell it. She takes her dowry money. They didn't call it dowry then. It was a bride wealth that they had, and she contributes that to the process. They're able to pay off their loans, and they have to move from the site. The people that they sell the land to don't need their little old log home anymore because they buy other property that has some nice frame homes on them, because everybody is kind of moving from the, not everybody at that time, everybody moves later, but a lot of people are moving from the site and abandoning their homes, and so they have a pick of the best ones to live in. This other one is abandoned, and as far as we can tell, based on the archaeology, nobody lives in the site after them. We found some artifacts up at higher levels, some farming equipment, a pen used to hold a wagon to the team, and a few other things. And on the surface of the property, there were bottles and 20th century items, but nothing down in the lower area but what we were able to find connected to the family.
Do you feel like Indiana Jones?
Well, I love the movie, but no, it's not quite as intense as that. I'm actually a cultural anthropologist rather than an archaeologist by academic training. My colleague Don Enders was the archaeologist, but I can say that my field work in cultural anthropology in the Republic of Suriname was very much like Indiana Jones. So this is much more peaceful and less intense. But
so it's interesting there. Can you talk a little bit about the dynamics of the family? It sounds like Lucy was very spiritual, and Asa wasn't, and influenced Joseph Sr. as well to be non-religious.
Yeah, they're spiritual, but in very different ways. Lucy grows up, she's part of that Great Awakening that moves up the Connecticut River Valley. And she comes from kind of the eastern side of the Green Mountains, where that's really going on. She's involved in the revivals there in the area. We can document a lot of revivals up in Chelsea, the township area north of them, out in Randolph, where they end up moving, and other places. And so very much a part of their experience. Joseph goes to those with her, but apparently to appease her more than anything. But he's religious, in a different context. The family's universalists, meaning Asel and Mary, and the children are all drawn into the universalist doctrine to a greater or lesser extent. And they are very much seen as heretics there in the area. There's in Randolph Township, there's a church where they bring everybody in, and they have to sign a document saying that they're opposed to the Universalists and will have nothing to do with them.
Who signed it?
Members of the congregation. There's the Congregationalists.
So Lucy was a Congregationalist, is that right?
Lucy is a Congregationalist here in Tunbridge, the Congregationalists and the Presbyterians meet together. Out in Palmyra, they do the same thing. She eventually becomes part of the Presbyterian, but it's the same thing that she's grown up with. They're kind of a combined community. The Universalists, Asel and Mary, appear to be involved in the Universalists before they even come to Vermont. The gentleman that helps them move to Vermont, he's from a Universalist congregation, but he doesn't live in their township, and so you wonder, well, how did they meet him if he weren't part of their religious denomination, that they were involved in all that? Excuse me. So, but there are other things that suggest that they're Universalists early. The very first meeting that Joseph Sr. and his brother Jesse go to in the township before their families even move north, that's the meeting where there's this big controversy over not everybody wants to support the main church in town, and that some people have different religious perspectives. And so it all kind of falls apart at that first meeting that they go to.
The main church in town was a Universalist church?
The Congregationalist church there in Tunbridge. And they're going to build a new church building, and they're talking about that in the township meeting, and that's the meeting that Joseph Sr. and Jesse go to, where people all of a sudden start saying, I'm not going to support that. And eventually they work it out to where the Universalists can meet in the building too. And so Asel and Mary and the sons, they have seats in the building, and historians have assumed that, well, that means that they were Congregationalists, they became Universalists later. No, the Universalists are using the building too. So they have assigned seats because they helped build the building and are involved in the community.
Okay.
But it's a community church and not a denominational church.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense, especially where resources are poor, you'd share a church. Even if you didn't have it.
And they do that initially, but yeah. So.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Mark Staker. In our next conversation, I asked Mark if Joseph was more similar to Joseph Sr. or Lucy.
By the time he's having his visions, that he's moved fully into his mother's camp in a lot of ways, but there are enough differences between the two that it makes him feel like he's unsure about sharing this with his family until he's encouraged to do so.
If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please subscribe for just $5 a month at patreon.com/gospeltangents, and you can hear the entire interview before everybody else. If you'd like to watch the entire video for just $8 a month, you can either subscribe on YouTube, Patreon, or my website, gospeltangents.com. Just click the yellow subscribe button, and I'll add you to our Gospel Tangents Insiders group so that you can see entire videos. For those interested in a PDF transcript, you can subscribe at either Patreon or on my website. For just $10 a month, I'll send you a PDF as soon as it's complete. If you'd like a copy of the paperback as well as a PDF, just sign up for $20 a month at either Patreon or my website, gospeltangents.com. Of course, you can buy individual transcripts at amazon.com and just do a search for Gospel Tangents Interview, and you can see all the things that we have there. Don't forget to support Gospel Tangents with an awesome t-shirt like one of these. You can subscribe at Apple Podcasts at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents. Get our latest updates at facebook.com/gospeltangents. Also, you can get our Twitter updates at gospeltangents. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here we've got more of our great videos. Thanks again.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.